Thank you, Andrew. It's great to be here. Another speaker from the great state of California. It is no surprise that there's two of us up here. That affidavit that Teresa referred to is painfully easily to do. You're just standing there registering your child for kindergarten. They flip over this little blue card, and you sign your signature, and that's all. There's no discussion. There's no mandatory meeting with the school nurse. There's certainly no discussion with your primary care provider about whether that's a good or a bad idea. And as I think Teresa's data illustrated, some of those, I think we've created the convenience PBE, that is a parent who can't find their record or doesn't want to go find their record. In California, you don't really have to, you can just sign that. So it makes it very challenging to monitor the behavior, and it's unclear still to this day how many of those PBEs really are opposed to vaccination and how many are not. And the same is true with alternative schedules. We hear a lot about parents seeking alternative schedules, but it's very hard to track and monitor just exactly how prevalent that experience is. So I'm going to report to you a small pilot experience in San Diego to try and use both our immunization information system and a managed care database to try and get a handle on just how frequent this behavior is. As you all know, or you wouldn't be here, recent vaccine safety concerns has led to an increasing number of parents seeking alternative schedules and avoiding vaccines altogether, and Teresa's data nicely illustrated for you what that trend looks like in California. The problem for all of us is that all of these alternative schedules involve some delay in immunization, and that leads to under-immunized populations that are at risk for outbreaks of disease. And for those of you who remember our 2008 measles experience in San Diego, that occurred in a school with a very high PBE rate, and all of the children who were involved in that outbreak were not immunized against measles. And that's what we're concerned about. Vaccine delay also impacts physicians. That is, it challenges the ability to accurately measure their immunization delivery. And we have an active pay-for-performance program in California that uses databases to monitor how providers are doing with immunization delivery, but has no good way to capture whether what they're doing is driven by parents who are requesting or demanding an alternative schedule. And immunization coverage rates are not really a great way to capture this, because if the child eventually gets immunized, if they come in enough times, even if they're following an alternative schedule, they will show up as up to date in a standard immunization cover audit. So we need some other ways to look at this phenomenon and hopefully measure it more real time, and thus the use of databases. Now, the use of an immunization information system to track this is not exactly a new idea, duh, or as the middle school child of one of my colleagues says, double duh. But you might also in your community think about tapping into your managed care databases, because they have pretty robust electronic systems and they're being used for things like pay for performance, and they're very interested in this too, so you might partner with them. So Teresa showed you the updated numbers from California. The bottom bar here is California rates. I stopped at 1.9. I'm disappointed to learn that we're now over 2.0 as a state. And the top black bar is San Diego. We have the privilege of being above the average in California, but for those of you who were lost on those maps, at least we're not the worst that in California. But we're probably the most populated county with a significant PBE problem. Now, this is some data from the managed care database just from several years, 2006 to 2009. This is, again, being used to measure physician performance. And this particular managed care group was dismayed to see all of these rates beginning to drop, rates for DTAP, IPV, basically you name it, and began to ask the question, why is this happening? Is this the PBE phenomenon? Are these patients completely opting out of vaccines? Or alternatively, is this partly a measure of alternative schedules and people picking and choosing which vaccines they're going to receive and when they're going to receive them? So it's one thing to look at the macro level that Teresa presented to you county by county within California, but personal belief exemptions and pockets of low coverage rate is a local phenomenon. That's illustrated here by this map from 2007 of immunization, of PBE rates across our county. So that's San Diego County. Mexico is on the bottom. Pacific is on the left. Camp Pendleton is on the north. Otherwise, we'd be running into Los Angeles. And nobody lives on the right-hand two-thirds of our county. So it's not so bad that the highest area, the school district, has a greater than 20% PBE rate is out there on the right-hand side. But I want you to focus on this area right here, because that's where everybody lives, because it's right by the ocean and the weather is nice. And I want you to focus on that because this is the same map. And what's on this map is individual schools and a count of the number of kindergarten students with PBEs in each of those schools. And the size of the dot is relative to the number of students. So the big red dots have 20 or more kindergarten students in that school who has exerted a personal belief exemption. And you can see there are lots of big red dots right over here where people like to live. This is the high socioeconomic status population of San Diego County. Contrast that to the lower part of the county where a lot of people live, but they're generally a much higher Hispanic population, which does a much better job of getting themselves immunized. Now, this whole map is superimposed on the median income, as you can see, just illustrating where the link between personal belief exemptions and, we will see in a minute, also alternative schedule practices are concentrated in these higher SES neighborhoods. So, we have the Sears schedule. That's near and dear to our hearts because Dr. Sears lives right up the street in Orange County. And this is the details of the Sears schedule for those of you who have never bothered to study it. It's the basic premise is never to get more than two vaccines at a single visit. It's largely predicated on the notion that aluminum in vaccines may be causing a problem and that therefore you should space that out. And it's also predicated on the notion that some diseases are worse than others or more prevalent than others. I'll point out, for example, that he doesn't recommend measles vaccine until 3 years of age. Had that been the case in San Diego when we started our measles outbreak, which stopped at 12 cases, I dare to say we would have had many, many more cases. But the detail to focus on with regard to the data I'm going to show you is that he recommends separating DTaP vaccine from both pneumococcal vaccine and from Hib vaccine. And as I've already pointed out, he separates varicella from measles and defers measles vaccine until 3 years of age. He recommends varicella vaccine at 18 months of age. Now, this is just one form of an alternative schedule. There's a lot of customization going on out there. But we took this schedule and asked the question, can we look for the non-simultaneous use of those vaccines that if you follow the ACIP, AAP, AAFP schedule, are given together in almost all cases. So we looked in both our San Diego Immunization Registry, our local IIS, and this small local primary care medical group database. Our IIS is for San Diego County, has a total population of just over 3 million. We have 124,000 children under two with two or more records in it and is used exclusively by our public health clinics, extensively by our nonprofit community health centers, and we have a growing number of private practice users. The CPMG database is a local managed care organization that had data from 9 separate office practices, pediatric practices. For this data, we looked at patients born in the year 2007 and had 2 separate populations, 2,000 patients from a high SES practice, so several practices in high SES geographic areas, and a smaller number, 600, from low SES areas. One of the criteria for being included in this data is that the patient had the same primary care provider throughout the first year of life to try and avoid issues of record scatter. So we developed queries to monitor the non-simultaneous use of vaccines that are typically given together when a physician and parent are following the ACIP schedule. We applied those queries to different ages, and in the case of our IIS, we're able to do that over multiple years. And these are the queries. For children between 6 weeks and 7 months of age, we asked what proportion of the patients who had received a DTAP but did not receive an IPV on the same day. Again, the SEER schedule would have you defer your IPV till later. Who received a DTAP but not a pneumococcal PCV7 vaccine on the same day? Or a simple query, who received less than 3 vaccines on the same day? In this age group, if you receive less than 3 vaccines on the same day, you are probably not following the ACIP schedule. For the CPMG database, they chose to evaluate children who did not receive Hib, DTAP, and IPV on the same day. So this is what our data looks like. The IIS slides all look like this. The private practices are in the vertically striped bars, and the community health centers are indicated here. Those are two, as a generalization, different SES populations, as you might expect. The community health centers have a very high percentage of Medicaid in our state called Medi-Cal coverage. And this looks at the trend. This is the first quarter data for these 6 years in a row from 2004 to 2009, and shows in the community health centers, actually, we had a decrease in the proportion of children who didn't receive IPV and DTAP on the same day. We'll take credit for that for the health department, and working aggressively with community health centers to improve their vaccine delivery. In contrast, in general, as you can see, private practices had a much higher rate as a background, and assuming that this is a real trend in the last 3 years, those numbers seem to be going up substantially, so that now somewhere between 12 and 14% of patients in private practices using our IIS are not receiving IPV and DTAP at the same time. You get a slightly different picture when you look at whether patients received DTAP but did not receive pneumococcal vaccine. It's not so clear what's going on here, although there is a slight trend increase in both private practice and community clinics, but overall, certainly in the community clinic system, that's going down. Now, part of this is colored by this period where we had PCV7 shortages, and particularly community clinics were sometimes challenged to have a supply. So I'm not sure this truly reflects the parental or physician practice with regard to alternative schedules. So one take-home message is, if you're going to use these sorts of data to try and track this, it may vary by which combinations of vaccines you look at, and it may reflect the value that pediatricians put or family physicians put on certain vaccines. If they're going to negotiate with a family about an alternative schedule, they may say, well, okay, you can defer your IPV because polio is not very prevalent, but you certainly should not defer your pneumococcal vaccine for young infants. This is the less than 3 immunizations on the same date, regardless of immunization type. Same general trend in the community clinics, dropping and improving vaccine delivery overall by 2009. And again, in the private practice clinics, we don't see the same rising trend that we saw with the IPV story. So again, we're going to need to explore these kinds of queries in more detail to learn which ones seem to reflect the most accurately exactly what's going on. Now, in the older age group, we looked at simultaneous use of MMR and varicella vaccine, and the other way around, actually. We looked at children who received a varicella vaccine and did not receive an MMR. Typically, those are given at the same time or even given as a combination vaccine together. And we all know that MMR has been the target of much of the vaccine safety concern in amongst our communities. So we thought that might be a good measure of how many people are separating these two vaccines or deferring the MMR altogether. And here, this looks much more like the first slide I showed you, with the private practices having a significant increase in the rate of non-simultaneous use of these two vaccines in the last 3 years, and much higher than in the lower SES population served by our community health centers. Now I'm going to shift to the CPMG database. We only have 1 year's data, so I can't show you these same trends, but what I can show you is the difference between 5 low SES practices that are in low SES neighborhoods compared to 4 practices on the right, which are in high SES neighborhoods. And as you can see, there is a lot of variability between practices. Some have none in the low SES practice, with the highest around 14%. And splitters here is defined as those who didn't receive the three vaccines that were in that query simultaneously, HIB, IPV, and DTaP. In the high SES practices, however, again, variability, but a much higher range, all the way up to 40%. In beautiful La Jolla, for those of you who know San Diego County, which is almost the highest SES neighborhood in our community. Overall, I'm now just focusing on the high SES practices. Overall, 16% of infants in those schedules received some form of a split schedule, ranging from 7 to 14. Overall, 84% of those infants were up to date with recommended immunizations by age 2, ranging from 72 to 94. But those who followed the split schedule had a compliance here means coverage rate. So of those following a split schedule, only 31% of 70 infants were up to date by age 2 using the standard measure. And of those following the recommended schedule, 94%. That's another double duh. If you don't follow the recommended schedule, you're more likely to get behind and not get your vaccines at the times when we usually measure them. In response to all of this, the California Immunization Coalition has developed some materials designed for providers. This particular sheet is available at that website to be downloaded and disseminated to your provider community. It's entitled Alternative Vaccine Schedules, Helping Parents Separate Fact from Fear. It relies heavily on Dr. Offit and some of his material that he's published so extensively on. And he's here in our audience today, and I hope is going to help us have a lively discussion on this topic. So in conclusion, we feel that immunization information systems and managed care databases can be useful to track the phenomenon of alternative vaccine schedule use. In San Diego, as I'm sure in most of your communities, there's a trend in private practice offices for increasing use of alternative schedules, but there is significant variability between practices and between geographic areas within your community, and that might help you guide where you should start your interventions. I'd like to acknowledge my co-authors and the leadership of the San Diego Public Health Department who helped us with all this work. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Dr. Sawyer. The floor is now open for question and answers. There is a microphone I see in the center of the room, so if you do have a question, please use the microphone. And we have a question.
Hi, I'm Stan Schaefer from Rochester, New York. Question for Mark. I was wondering if the public health authorities in San Diego leveraged the measles outbreak to really push the idea of on-time immunization and not delaying immunizations.
Yeah, believe me, we are milking the measles outbreak as long as it can be milked. It's been 2 years, and yet we quote it like it happened yesterday. I think it is quite illustrative of the problem, though. The pockets of high either personal belief exemption use or alternative schedule use, creating situations where outbreaks will and have, as most of you know, continued to occur. So that, unfortunately, has not led us yet to a state where, or a situation where at the state level we could consider changing the California law that would make personal belief exemptions a little bit more challenging to obtain. I don't think in California we will ever get rid of them, but I think it makes a lot of sense to at least make sure that families are accurately educated about the situation before they make that decision, and I know many of you have the good fortune to live in states where that does have to happen. So I hope we at least get there in California.
I'm Lydia McCoy with the Colorado Children's Immunization Coalition, and I have two questions. The first one is, are there any common factors in school districts with higher PBE rates for school administrators who are encouraging parents to sign PBE statements, knowing that they're planning to get caught up on their immunization? Are there common factors with either kind of the culture of that community being a little bit anti-vaccine leaning, or are they more rural areas that are having real difficulty getting kids enrolled in school, and so it's more just a, we need to do whatever we can to get this kid started?
That's a good question. There's a mix of both people who are very knowledgeable in what vaccines they don't want their children to get, and who are very well educated. And there's also some people who are on the border and who may not know very much about immunizations. And if you have someone who will sit and talk with them, that they'll say, yes, I'll immunize my child.
In San Diego, we've certainly heard anecdotes where the school clerk or even the school nurse has received some pressure from their administration to just let these kids get into school because they're worried about their financial reimbursement, or they're even, you know, benevolently motivated to get the kids into school to be educated. But it does create a problem for those of us in public health.
Okay, thanks. And my second question is, has there been any discussion about using the term delayed schedule instead of alternative schedule? I'm just thinking about the generation of parents around my age. Alternative is a positive thing. We listened to alternative music. We did everything as alternative as possible. And an alternative schedule is something that's appealing, whereas a delayed schedule, which is an accurate description of the schedule, is something that really tells people what choice they're making.
No, that's a fantastic point. I mean, I think that is the point, that what's wrong, you know, the question the doctor gets is, what's wrong with an alternative schedule? Well, what's wrong with it is you're delaying immunizations and delaying protection. So I think that's a great suggestion.
Hi, Sherilyn Kraft from Virginia. My question is, what were the points of success for the one doctor's office in the high SES area where they were able to maintain a low alternate vaccine or delayed vaccine request? Because our command has decided not to engage them. If the patients want alternate vaccine schedules, they can seek care elsewhere. That's the stance that our providers have now taken. And it's actually motivating parents to come in line with the standard of care. I was just wondering what their success was.
Right. Well, I don't have any real data on that topic. I anecdotally certainly know that the practices with the highest rate both have the problem of the population that they serve, but also have the personal attitude that's more flexible with regard to allowing and negotiating with families on this topic. And you know, at least the Academy of Pediatrics would encourage providers not to discharge from their practice, to continue to work with them. But there's all levels of just how eager you are to accommodate parents and either make them come back several times before you make them agree to an alternative schedule is one approach that I've heard. So I think it's an important question. We need to learn as much as we can and as many tricks as we can on how to talk with these families. I went to an interesting exercise in Orange County this last weekend where physicians with actors as role players went through a discussion both on just complete refusing vaccines and how to communicate the problem with alternative schedules. So I think we need to get that information out there more to give providers the tools that they need to really engage in this discussion.
Chris Calvin with the Academy of Pediatrics in California. I understand that AAP has made some specific forms for practitioners to use. Do they address the alternative schedule when they ask the parents to sign it and say that they don't want to be vaccinated? Do they have some that say sign it if you want to be vaccinated differently?
It's a good question, Chris. You ought to know.
That's why I'm asking you.
I know the Academy has a general form that they encourage pediatricians to consider using when a family is not following their advice. I don't know that it's specific to alternative schedules versus just refusing vaccines in general. And I don't really know to what extent people use that form. I have heard anecdotally that pediatricians don't feel that really covers them medical legally necessarily, which is one of the motivations to use such a form.
Hello, I'm Alicia from Kentucky, and I have a question about physicians who discharge patients who do not follow the ACIP recommended schedules. I wonder if you have received pressure from those physicians to make legislation more strongly worded to eliminate PBEs.
Well, certainly, I think the consensus in the medical community in California is we would like to see personal belief exemptions more difficult to obtain, that they're too easy. The fact that people are doing them out of convenience is a symptom of a problem with regard to the way our legislation works. So I think there is support for that. There's been discussion in the professional societies and the California Medical Association about trying to bring legislation forward to make them more difficult. But that's a complicated and long process, as Chris can attest to, since she's heavily involved in such legislative advocacy. So I think it's going to be several years before that happens.
I'm Mary Beth Kostloff-Petracco from Suffolk County Department of Health Services in New York, and I recently read where Sears printed a retraction, and he's now saying to follow the ACIP schedule, and I was just wondering if that has any recent impact. I know you probably only have anecdotal evidence. In our county, and actually in Nassau and Suffolk counties, the gift du jour at baby showers was that stupid book. I'd like you to know that I give Paul Offit's book for a baby shower gift and just gave it to 3 baby showers. Thank you, Dr. Offit. And actually, just anecdotally, what we're hearing locally, since Sears published that, it has made some impact on the fence sitters, and I just wanted to know if it had impacted California at all.
You can comment on how your data will allow us to measure an impact. I actually hadn't heard Dr. Sears has changed his tune.
Well, you know where I got it, because I on the Every Child by Two listserv, so it came, and they monitor all of the press releases every day, and it came up, and I printed it. But if you go to the ECBT website, I'm sure you can find it through there. You know, like, just go back and, you know, pull the link up, and I'm sure Amy Pisani won't mind if you ask her where it was, and she'll help you find it if you can't find it yourself.
Well, I think that would be great if that's true. Certainly the systems and the data were shared at this presentation should allow us to measure the impact of any changes or new books, good or bad. So I think that's the point, is we do need to track the phenomenon and see how it's influenced by various events in our community. I do know that Dr. Sears doesn't consider himself anti-vaccine. I've heard him in debates, I met with a pediatrician this weekend who debated him once, and he came up before the debate to say, well, which one of us is the anti-vaccine guy? So he thinks he's doing a service to this subset of the community who has concerns about vaccines. So.
Good morning. My name is Mona Gale. I'm a Symetrica contractor working with ISD. I have two questions. In terms of the PBEs, other than convenience, do you have any data on what these personal beliefs are as to why they're looking for exemptions? And number two, with the alternative schedules, I know of a lot of parents who are using other industrialized countries, especially European schedules, as alternative schedules, and how does that differ, and why would it be different in different countries as to the public health benefits?
Okay, so for PBEs and why people take exemptions, what was alluded to before was that individuals do take exemptions for convenience. So we do have some anecdotal evidence where local health department immunization coordinators have seen post-it notes on immunization records that say this is a convenience exemption and please follow up later.
But, you know, I think we all know the ones who are taking real exemptions are doing it because vaccines overwhelm your immune system, that thimerosal is bad for you, aluminum is bad for you, all of the things that you have all heard over and over again. So we need to keep trying to get the accurate information out there on those topics. With regard to alternative schedules used in other countries, I'm not very familiar with the details of any but Mexico, but in general, they don't space out vaccines extensively. They certainly follow different intervals and different ages at which vaccines are given, but they are still clustered together in visits to facilitate the delivery. And that's the problem we face here, is the alternative schedules most people follow end up delaying vaccines, and ultimately, in some children, lead to them never getting immunized.
I have a question for Teresa. You found great variability from county to county within California in terms of the percentage of PBEs. Mm-hmm. And was that perhaps partially because in some localities the school districts were informing families about, you know, potential consequences of delaying or not having their child immunized. And that brings up a sort of a second question is, do you think it would be possible for the State Health Department in California, working with the State Education Department, to set up some sort of a requirement that schools provide information to families about the potential consequences before they sign the release?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So to address your latter question, we've been working with our regulations, with the Office of Administrative Law, and we've been talking with them about the possibility of creating an online, some type of educational component where parents would be required to read this component and then before they signed or took the exemption. So we're in the process of determining whether or not we can go forward with that. In addition, your first question was, the counties in California there's a wide range of PBEs. And I think looking at the presentation by San Diego, there are pockets. I think that it behooves us to look closer at, I think even at the county level, there's so much variation that I think that was a great demonstration that within even one county, there can be higher numbers of PBEs, which is related to many different things.
But you said there's also variation from school to school and district to district, but I don't know that the schools necessarily understand that if a child attending that school gets one of these vaccine-preventable diseases, that can affect many other children in the school and have a profound effect on the school as a whole.
Right.
And so, you know, education of the school district personnel and perhaps down to the level of the individual school nurses about this issue, I think, is crucially important.
That'd be, yes, I completely agree. Yeah.
My name is Venerdi Fries from Davis County, Utah. Dr. Sawyer, I was just thinking, you talk about making PBEs more difficult for clients to get. I was thinking if charging clients to sign for PBEs has been looked at, and even the requirement for the federal registers allowed vaccine administration fee. Because in our clinic, we see all these clients wanting a waiver, and we have lines of people waiting for vaccine, and they get to the desk, and we sign them. It's like they get the priority when, in all reality, we don't agree with what they're doing. So, have you looked at charging clients for signing PBEs?
No, I mean, the California budget is in very bad shape, so that might help.
It's going to be like charging for luggage on a
yes,
plane.
Yes.
Now we have to, I like it.
Right, but I do think we ought to shift the discussion slightly. I'm not really trying to make them harder to get. I want parents to get them with good information and not get them casually and not appreciate the consequences, as Dr. Schaefer just pointed out, the potential consequences not only to their child but to their neighbors and their community in general. And I think that's what, at least in our state, we need to strive for. Some of you already are there with regard to the way your process works.
The way I rationalize it in my clinic is it will take as much resources to investigate a communicable disease in the school. And
right.
They seem to agree with that, so they pay up.
Well, one flavor of the discussion about changing our system was to require them to go to their physician, to go to their pediatrician or family physician and have a discussion that the physician then says, signs off that at least we had a discussion. And that will cost them money and time in order to do it. Sandra Jo.
Hi, I'm Sandra Jo from California, and I work with Teresa. And I just wanted to just put this out that there's a lot of important lessons here, but one of the biggest lesson is California has a school law, like most of you, that started in 1977, and it is a legislated activity to have this mandated vaccination. And unfortunately, California's law is quite complicated, as some of you have, and it's also currently our legislature is now got term limits, so we have to constantly re-educate new legislators, et cetera. And undoing a complicated law is really hard. And right now, for example, we have a pertussis prohibition at 7 years old that needs to, the law has to be changed. Then we have to write regulations, which then have to go to a public forum, all of which you're looking at about 5 years and a lot of money. And by the way, we're broke. And so, you know, undoing all these laws has been really hard. And California's law in its inception was really good, but it required school nurses. And what we've lost is school nurses. And so as a result, what we find happening also is when you go to register your child, in California, this is the kindergarten roundup is in May, and is in March and April. And so instead of, even though the law says that it's kind of first physical entry into school, they're saying, well, you have to have your vaccines all up to date right now, or you can't get into school in September. Well, that's not correct, but they're doing it because they don't have personnel to check those records in September. Everything is so that everything is easy. It's a health clerk, and you've got to make this system. Most parents want to comply with the system, but if, in fact, they're being told to get the vaccines in March, they have an appointment for a physical in June, they're not going to do it. And so they go into kind of the PBE hopper. So just a word of caution, our law has stalled. We have 10 years since we've had a new regulation. Trying to get that going is impossibly hard right now because we also pay schools for checking these vaccines, which we're out of money in that fund. So, you know, everything has become very difficult, and putting these things like Mark discussed and Teresa discussed, putting these kind of, you have to have completed this or have done, we'd love to do that, but everything seems to be on legislation. So look at your laws and preemptively change your law to be a little more flexible if you have that opportunity also.
We'll be passing a collection plate before you leave.
Jane Seawood, CDC. I was wondering, especially around the San Diego outbreak, which we were closely involved in with California and San Diego County Health Department, there were 4 children infected in that outbreak who were under 12 months, and a number of the parents were extremely upset about that. I'd wondered if you'd heard any rumblings of potential lawsuits being filed by those kinds of parents whose children get infected by other parents' choices. There was certainly a lot on the blogs at the time discussing that.
Right. No, I have not actually heard that any of that came to litigation. There were several innocent bystanders who were exposed simply by coming to their doctor's office, were under a year of age, and therefore had not yet been immunized. And those parents were very upset not only that their child got sick, but that they were quarantined after that for a long period of time. So it's an interesting phenomenon. I was surprised. I thought there would be some secondary legal action out of our outbreak, and I guess I'd ask anyone in the audience whether we were not the only outbreak during that year, whether anyone had an experience where somebody raised this legal challenge to the situation.
Okay, well, I think we heard a lot of wonderful questions today and some very interesting ideas. Please join me in thanking our presenters, Teresa Lee and Mark Sawyer. And stick.